Hello, and welcome to The Trumpet, the official podcast of Elephant Room Productions. Today, I am joined by Bob Kerr, one of our most recent playwrights for our workshops. Thank you so much for talking to me today, Bob.
Thanks, my pleasure. Thank you, too, for having me on.
Absolutely. And not to pull back the curtain too much for our listeners of how I do this podcast, but this is actually a first for me. This is a two-podcast day. Katie's interview was actually recorded just a few hours ago, so I'm still really jazzed up on podcast energy, so I'm really looking forward to continuing our conversations about theater. But first off, Bob, thank you for not only joining us for this workshop, but joining us again, because you've worked with us twice for Ventilator Blues. So I would love to pick your brain about it. It is a very brilliant play. But first off, can I just ask you just a little introduction for yourself, your theatrical background and stuff of the like?
Okay, well, I first started writing plays when I was in high school. I had actually already been writing short stories for a while, but then I had an English teacher in high school who she also directed most of the drama productions, and she also sponsored a one-act festival at the school every year, and then students could direct plays or I don't remember if I'd seen anyone actually write and direct plays at that point, but I did have a short story, which was a very emo kind of teenage story about a teenager who attempts suicide.
Well, I mean, as is to be expected in high school.
So I took a story and I adapted it into a play. And I actually directed that. You know, I cast some friends from high school in the play and actually put it up. And that's sort of how I first got my start. This is backing up. It's a little bit out of order, but I was actually inspired, I think, to try playwriting first because there is the same teacher that I talked about. She directed a production of The Fantastics.
Oh, I love that play. I've always wanted to do that.
And just watching it, it just kind of blew my mind, just the way that you could use such simple elements to conjure such a detailed and such a full world. And so after I saw that, that's what actually got me wanting to try something theatrical, you know, with my writing. So, I wrote and directed that in my junior year in high school, and then I enjoyed that enough where I kind of came back the next year, and that play I actually also submitted for the Young Playwrights Festival, it was an off-Broadway festival for writers who were I think it was like 19 years and old and younger, so I actually submitted the second play that I wrote and directed myself at high school, and then it was accepted for that, and actually it was selected for the festival, so I got an off-Broadway production directed by, like, of all people, Christopher Durang. So
wait, what? Pardon my language,
but with that level of encouragement, I think that just got me to keep going with playwriting in the future.
Okay, that is, I don't know that we're going to beat that story on this podcast anytime soon. That is amazing. People who know me well will know I have a very specific sense of humor, and Christopher Durang is everything that I strive to.
And actually that second play, that was about a teenage boy who's questioning his religion, and I guess he was sort of in the back of my mind, you know, someone who also does, like, great satires that are kind of related to.
Oh God, yeah, no, that is. I'm thinking about what kind of a field day Christopher Durang would have with that subject material, because I've worked on a couple. I've never been in a Christopher Durang play, but I did work some crew in college. There was we did a production called Durang Squared. It was a performance of Actor's Nightmare, followed immediately by Baby with the Bathwater, which are two, if you don't know Christopher Durang, it's a yeah. great introduction to what kind of world he can create.
Exactly, yeah.
I thought it was neat also that you, going back a little bit to your fantastic story, I will say I concur. One of my favorite things about theater, and something I strive for in any production that I direct or that I see, I just love how little sometimes you need to tell a story and make the audience believe a story. So it's like, I've seen shows with lavish sets and $1,000 budgets and lights and all that. I've seen other shows in a black box with two people and one block, and I've mm-hmm. gotten the same connection from it. It's really remarkable.
Yeah. I almost say that, like, I feel that some of my most intense theatrical experiences have been like staged readings, which are, you know, script in hand, but the actors have had some time to rehearse, you know, so there's been some time to work on the performances. But there's basically no set, minimal, if any, costumes, but the actors and the writers just been focusing on the story of the play for maybe a week. And somehow there's just something about the way the performance is so stripped down that makes it more intense, I think, sometimes than when you have like a full detailed set and costumes and sound design and all of that. So
That's kind of reflective.
That's one thing about the theater is that I almost feel like the play, like, it doesn't really take place on stage, but it actually takes place in the mind of the audience and the performers, really. So it's so it's almost like an act of collective imagination, and that, you know, and then like all of the physical elements are there to kind of serve that. But yeah, but I've kind of but my working theory now is the play really takes place in people's minds, yeah. and not on the stage, really.
Well, I have chills now. It's funny you say that. Like, one of my favorite mediums, which is very bizarre. I'm a stage actor. I love film, TV, stage, all of that. One of my favorite mediums is audio, weirdly enough, just because you are able to create that whole space in your mind. But no, I totally feel you. And even Ventilator Blues, which we're going to talk about more in a little bit, from reading that, you know, even outside of a stage reading, you've masterfully written this very powerful story to, in essence, take place in about two blank rooms for most of it, which I think is brilliant, because it gives one of my favorite plays, and I'm not saying this to butter up the artistic director of ERP, who I know is listening right now, but one of my favorite plays is a play that she wrote called Captive that we talked about on this podcast, that is similar to Ventilator Blues, all in one room with very, very limited scenery. And it just gives that main actor, or the main actress, a huge challenge. So I guess is that generally your writing style? Kind of that minimalist design with more character-driven and, goal-driven stories?
I think as I've gone along, I think I've kind of tried to give myself sort of fewer tools to work with in a way. I feel that I've always tried to do things that are character driven, but one thing that I've been trying to do as I go along is try to have, you know, like smaller cast, try to do maybe even like a single set, and just see what kind of stories I can tell with having such limited means, in a way. So, So like the plays that I was writing, like maybe 10 or so years ago, would have larger casts and take place in multiple locations, and would maybe be more extravagant in certain ways theatrically. But for some reason lately, I've tried to narrow the focus and try to sort of give myself fewer tools to work with and see how that gets me to kind of dig deeper into the characters and the story and the situation.
And do you have any other theatrical experience other than, or areas of focus other than playwriting? Do you act, direct?
I've done, like mostly in school. When I was in school, I was a theater major. So of course I took like acting classes and, directing classes. And then, after I got out of school, I co-founded a group in Minneapolis called Bedlam Theater. And then I directed, I think, one or two pieces for that. And I also had some plays performed and also, acted in a couple things. But since then I've kind of narrowed my focus to writing, because I feel that, but I will say though that I think I learned maybe almost as much about writing plays from acting classes, either that I've taken or that I've sat in on, as I have from specifically writing classes, because it's I just found it really helpful to find out the way that actors think and approach a script. And and it's the kind of thing, like, I feel like I don't really have the talent as an actor, because I feel like I can do that sort of intellectual or mental work, but I just can't find a way to embody it and sort of, you know, carry it out in my voice and my body. But it did, like, really help me to know, like, how an actor approaches a script, just to
absolutely, kind of, yeah,
think through what a character is trying to, you know, accomplish at a given point. And I had a playwriting fellowship at Juilliard, and as part of that I got to sit in on acting classes that Michael Kahn taught there. And one thing that he would always encourage the actors to do is actually, like, even when they're doing a scripted scene, you know, and he would have them, you know, stick exactly to the dialogue, but he would encourage them to always have, like almost like an element of improvisation in a way.
Right.
And
right.
Always be reacting, like, you know, in the scene, like what's actually happening on stage between the two actors in that moment, and not just get caught up in reproducing the same thing every single time. So, so that's something too that, you know, I don't know how successful I am, but I always try to keep that in mind, to try to, like, leave a little space for the actors to be able to play around in the script.
No, I definitely felt that when I was reading Ventilator Blues. So I guess my other playwriting question for you is, what is your primary writing style? Because Ventilator Blues is some very, very heavy material, but there seems to be a trend. I don't know if it's clearly not an intentional trend, because we read through whatever plays are submitted, but there seems to be this trend of shows we've workshopped through the reading series that deal with some very serious, heavy-hitting material, yet there's a lightness to it. There's definitely moments that make you laugh. There's moments that make you wonder whether or not you should be laughing. So do you tend to write mostly those mixes, or do you kind of mix it up between straight-up comedy, straight-up drama?
I guess there's always, like, some mixture of the two. I guess I almost feel like Ventilator Blues, for what I usually do, it's maybe a bit more on the sort of serious side or the darker or more harrowing side, but I feel like there's often some element of darkness, or at least extreme eccentricity, in what I write. I always have trouble just coming up as just sort of like a pithy one word description of what I try to do, just because I do find, like, the sort of juxtaposition of tones, or maybe even sometimes sort of ambiguity of tones.
Well, then I guess I'll amend that question.
And as an audience member.
Well, I guess I'll amend that question then. What's your favorite style to write in?
I kind of find it hard to answer that question in a way, because I feel like stylistically my plays can be really different one to the next.
Right.
And it just seems to be determined by whatever the germ of the idea is that I start with. It seems to kind of dictate if I'm going to try to do something that's maybe more comical or more serious or more absurd or more realistic. So I don't feel like I have a particular favorite style. It's just that whenever I get the kernel of an idea that I really want to follow, I just follow where it leads me, I guess.
No, I love that. That's an amazing way to write. So I guess one more before we head to the scene. Can you set up Ventilator Blues for us a little? Just kind of tell my listeners what kind of the play is about, and then also if you could please set up the scene we're going to hear.
So Ventilator Blues is it's set in the same directions I put it as, a little bit ahead of and to one side of the present. And it's in the sort of dystopian police state in the near future. And there are two women, a mother and her grown daughter, who have been taken in, and they're being held in a high-tech facility. And they're being interrogated by a disembodied, apparently computer-generated voice. And occasionally they're allowed to talk to each other. And a lot of the play has to do with them trying to figure out why they have been taken in and what it is that they need to get, what it is that they need to do to get released.
Awesome.
And this particular scene takes place about halfway into the first act. And it's after the mother and daughter have realized that they're able to communicate to each other intermittently. So they've sort of fallen into routine, and then the scene has to do with the daughter talking about how she was arrested or abducted by the police state before she was taken in.
All right, awesome. Let's take a listen.
Grace and her mother, Alice, are being held captive in a high-tech detention facility. They are in separate cells, but they are occasionally allowed to speak to each other. In both cells, the rising three-note arpeggio.
Mom? Are you there? Mom? Mom!
Alice starts awake.
Where is she? You're supposed to let me talk to
her! Grace? Grace, I'm here!
You didn't answer.
I was sleeping.
Oh. I was worried that...
I'm fine.
I didn't mean to wake you. Do you want to go back to...
No, let's talk while we have the chance.
What were we talking about the last time? When they cut us off?
You were in the middle of telling me how you...
Right.
You'd just gotten something in the mail.
A flyer. It was an ad for a new dress shop downtown. In the corner, it said, "Present this flyer for a free gift." I'd spent every single day for 3 weeks doing everything I could to find you. I'd reported you missing. I'd called everyone either of us knew. I taped up signs all over town. I was exhausted. I hate to say this, but I was starting to give up hope. And I don't know. I just wanted something for myself. So I took that flyer and went downtown. The store was almost empty, but that didn't strike me as strange. I mean, it had just opened and it was 11 o'clock on a Wednesday. I felt removed from the world. I could forget the riots, the war, the fact that you were missing. I could just spend an hour looking at clothes. The sales girl came up to me and asked if I needed help. Like an idiot, I said, "I'd like my free gift." She took the flyer and she said she needed to scan it in. She came back a minute later carrying a dress. I asked her if it was the free gift. "It's still being processed," she said. "In the meantime, why don't you try this on?" It was a summer dress, navy, with these white and pink and pale blue blossoms. That's when I should have known, when she came back with that damn dress.
Known what?
Whenever I wasn't out looking for you or putting up signs, I'd look at clothes online. It was how I tried to relax, and I'd keep coming back to that dress. I'd almost buy it, but I'd change my mind. 10 minutes later, I'd be back at the website, almost buying it again, changing my mind. And that sales girl just happens to come out with that exact same dress? Such an idiot. Anyway, the sales girl took me to the dressing room, and I tried on the dress. I must have spent 10 minutes admiring myself in the mirror like some vain imbecile. When I was done, I put my own clothes back on and tried to open the door. It wouldn't move. The latch was stuck. I called out for the sales girl, but she didn't come. Behind me, there was a click. I turned around, and the mirror opened. It swung open like a door. At that moment, it occurred to me, this could be it. I might not be going home. My next thought was, it serves me right. I stopped looking for her. And finally, I realized, maybe this is how I'll finally find her. So I stepped through the mirror, or the hole where the mirror had been, and wandered in the dark until I found myself in the back of a van. The door slammed shut, the engine started up, and the van started to move. After that, I got the same treatment as you. Hours later, they let me out of the van. I got the blinding light, the voice telling me to strip, the cold shower, the jumpsuit on the hook, the door in front of me opening, the one I'd come through, closing behind me, over and over, until I found myself in here. You know, that sales girl is the last human being I've seen.
I'm so sorry, Grace.
I must have made it so easy for them. I mean, it's not like they went through all the trouble of setting up a whole fake store for me, right? I can't be that important. There have to be others. Enough to make that kind of charade worth the effort. There has to be a type, some moron that comes running when they see a pretty dress. Apparently, that moron is me.
And we're back. So my first impression, before you talk about the history and all this play, I just gotta say, I was blown away. I was unfortunately not able to be at the initial reading. I live in Philadelphia, and I believe the initial reading took place in New York. And unfortunately, I also could not go to the remounted workshop, the new draft. So my first exposure with the play was the draft that you guys workshopped in New York. And I was just on the edge of my seat the whole time. And we have very few plays that deal with a dystopian future. I think we've done one other, and that was another one we workshopped earlier this year, but that was not even on the same planet. So this kind of chilling look at the society, not quite knowing how far in the future it is, was really, really intense for me to listen to. So what was your inspiration behind this piece?
Well, I guess that's sort of the inspiration, which it wasn't exactly where I started with the play. I think it's just what I worked towards as I started writing it. But, and this is actually a play that I started writing actually about, I think, 4 or 5 years ago now, in a very different form. I can probably get into in a minute how the play itself changed over the process of writing it. But as I was writing it, I think just sort of concerns that I had just about different sort of trends or different sort of features of contemporary life having to do with technology and the capacities for surveillance. The use of technology to kind of mediate our communications with each other, and and the way that it can affect even our most intimate relationships. I think think I should sort of all kind of, you know, went into the hopper as I was writing it, and I was just trying. I guess I just started carrying it to just whatever paranoid extreme I could come up with.
No, it's definitely very chilling, especially the. If to me, one of the most fascinating things about it was the voice, the kind of computer voice that keeps interrogating them. Just that the unsettling calm of just that kind of very mechanical, you know, it would be one thing if it was someone yelling into the microphone or someone physically there assaulting, just that sense of unease you feel from it being a very calm, collected, no, repeat the quest, like that very repetitive thing was just so unsettling, but I mean that in a great way. It's brilliant. Have you written any other pieces that take place in the kind of not so distant future, or is this kind of your first venture ahead of the present?
I guess now I'm trying to think back. I mean, I guess, I think this is the first one that I've written that's been sort of like a futuristic or a near future sort of setting. I mean, there are other plays that have like sort of fantastical or science fictional kind of elements to them. But they've been kind of set more, I guess, in a more contemporary world with other sort of science fictional elements. And, you know, and I guess the thing about this play too, like I almost feel like it isn't necessarily that far in the future necessarily, especially just when you think about like the technologies that are being worked on now, having to do with machine learning and artificial intelligence and things like that.
Well, there's that old joke that like every movie about an AI or an artificial sentient thing is made with more and more brilliant technology, and what they don't understand is every one of those movies, the technology we develop for the movies is getting us closer to the thing that the movie is trying to warn us against. But it's a Eugene Merman joke for you. So what I thought was really interesting, because you don't see this as much in older plays, and it's a very positive trend I'm seeing in plays and film and TV now, but the main focus of this play is two female protagonists. So what was your reasoning behind that?
It's not that I had anything in particular about gender that I had in mind, but I think at some point I decided to try to write plays where the cast is at least 50% women, and actually the first version of the play was very different because some of it took place actually in the house where Alice and Grace live, and then and you also had two other characters which are Francine, which is Alice's daughter, and Grace's sister, who they refer to sometimes in the play, but you don't actually meet in the current version. And then Shane, who is Alice's granddaughter and Grace's nephew.
You mean grandson. Too. Yeah.
So I guess I was just trying to go for, when I first had the idea of the play, I thought I'd try to do something that, you know, you just had that balance of three women versus one man, just to try to try to do my part to give, you know, hopefully good roles for women out in the world. And then as I was working on the play, it became kind of unwieldy because the scenes that make up the play now, originally started as almost kind of flash forwards from the scenes that took place in the house.
Right, right.
And I decided, well, I should just really focus on either the house or this detention facility. And then I guess because the detention facility seemed to be the more challenging thing to do, I guess sort of perversely, I decided to go with that one.
And, it works. It works very well.
Yeah. That's sort of like a roundabout way, and I don't know if it really addresses like the idea behind it being two women, but that's kind of how the play kind of came about. And when I focused on this part of the play, it just happened to be these two women that were in there. But I think also as a writer, I think it's it's just a way to kind of challenge myself.
Right, right.
To try to write from a different perspective, and also challenge myself to not necessarily, just really force myself to find ways not to fall back on any kind of stereotypes that I might be tempted to as a guy writing a play about two women.
No, right. Well, you brought up something really interesting about losing characters and losing locations in the drafts. How many iterations, how long have you been working on this, if you don't mind me asking?
I think it's been about 4 or 5 years now that I've been since I first got the idea of the play, which was with four characters and it was taking place in this house. But I really kind of like lost track of the iterations because sometimes I do partial rewrites, I do rewrite of one section or something, and I'd be working on the play, I'd bring some scenes into a writing group, and then I'd think, oh, that's not working, I'd throw that out, but in its current form with the location in the two cells and just the two characters on stage, I think that's, it's been about maybe 3 or 4 years that I've been working with this version of the play.
So I just want to bring up again, since we mentioned this earlier, that the version that we workshopped back in New York in April was the second draft that we had personally worked with. So I guess I want to ask, how did our feedback from the ears experience help shape the play to the next stage that it got to?
Well, I think one thing, maybe the biggest thing that I took away from the feedback from the first reading, which I think you're referring to the reading that was just recorded,
yeah,
and was sent to me, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I think one big thing that I took away from that was, because in this play, like, one of the challenges I think that I set myself was to, try to convey things about the relationship, about the world at large, about the backstory of the play, maybe almost kind of indirectly, and then, leave a lot of gaps for the audience to try to fill in, some of which maybe there are enough clues to do so, and then some maybe not, but I think the feedback that I got, it kind of encouraged me to really be more explicit about certain things, I guess, which I think just when I was trying so hard to be sort of clever about being indirect about telling the story, I think I was maybe more indirect than I really needed to be, so it kind of encouraged me to be more explicit and actually kind of think through certain things about the logic of the story too. So it's actually really helpful to get that feedback and actually have a chance to work with the same group of people again on a new version to see how effective the changes were.
And I have to ask, since I wasn't able to attend the New York workshop, but how did the experience working kind of more directly in the workshop setting differ from being a little more removed from the feedback?
It's actually really helpful to sort of be in the room as everyone's kind of talking through how they made sense of the play. Because normally, like in these workshop situations, my approach is usually to kind of sit there and just kind of take in what the actors and the director are wrestling with, and if there are direct questions to me, I'm happy to answer them, but in that kind of situation, I find that I get more out of it if I kind of sit back and listen and try to hear what the challenges are that everyone is wrestling with, rather than trying to tell them what I intended from moment to moment. So probably at least the first half of the rehearsal process was actually a lot of table work where the actors would read through the script, but then every so often the director would stop and Lauren would stop, and then everyone would kind of discuss the questions that came up, and then they would talk through their theories of how things fit together or what things meant. And I just kind of sat there and I took a ton of notes, especially when the questions that they asked were maybe the questions that I wouldn't necessarily want, you know, actors and audience to necessarily caught up in, or if the theories that they were coming up with were contradictory to what
meeting.
I had in mind.
Yeah.
So it was good to like sit there and take notes. So that I can go back and for the next draft I can think about that and just find ways to make things clearer that aren't clear enough and so forth.
Well, if this draft is any indication, I think this play is going in a very, very good direction, and I am very excited to read whatever iteration it comes into next. Well, before we wrap up today, since this is a theater podcast, I always love ending on just kind of a lighthearted theater question. So I guess I'll just go to my go-to, because I normally ask favorite play or genre or playwright. We kind of hit on a lot of those boxes. So one of my kind of go-to reserve fun questions is, if you could share a drink with any character from any play, who would it be and why?
Yeah, I think the character that I would most enjoy sitting down for a drink with would be George from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. I mean, maybe he's not someone who'd want to be married to, for example.
No, the reason I'm laughing is because...
But I just love the language in that play, and especially his dialogue, He just seems like the kind of character it would be a lot of fun just to sit down, have a drink, and just pick his brain about just about any subject.
I agree with you. The reason I'm laughing so much is because the second-to-last episode that we have up, I talked to Lauren about her play that we workshopped and production we're coming up with, and when I asked her that question, her answer was Martha from Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. So I think that is very evocative of it's very evocative of the type of people we like to work with, because they're just like us. I'm trying to remember who I know the last episode I said Bottom from A Midsummer Night's Dream, but I'll throw another one out. Why not? Mame Dennis from the musical Mame. It's a musical that is very close to my heart. The character of Mame is very close to me because of how much her philosophy in life and how much her energy reminds me of my grandmother. And throughout that play, there is never a moment where she doesn't have, no matter, she goes through the Great Depression, she goes through losing jobs, she goes through almost losing her great nephew, like in custody. And there's never a point in that play where her liquor cart is not stocked to the brim of the liquor. So I love that energy of let's have a party. Similar to George and Martha, but their energy is a lot more twisted. Oh god, now between you and Lauren, I need to watch that movie again, because that is one of my favorite movies. Thanks. Well, Bob, thank you so much for coming on and talking with me today. It was an absolute joy to read Ventilator Blues, and I know speaking to Lauren, Phil, Katie, Chris, everybody in the New York crew, and the other elephants who were there, that the workshop was a tremendous experience to work on. We're incredibly honored that you chose to take your play another step with us. So thank you again.
Yeah, it was an incredible experience for me, too. I just can't tell you how much I got out of the whole process.
Oh, thank you so much. So To our listeners, thank you again for listening today. Remember, if you are an aspiring playwright and you would like some feedback, please, please, please send us a play at erpsubmissions@gmail.com. Remember, every story deserves to be heard, so join our elephant herd today. Thank you again for listening, and we will see you next time. Goodbye.